This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is a deeply rooted cultural issue that goes back to a view around how people are treated. Having a lot of wealth is not something that's flaunted or encouraged, it's discouraged. People are treated as equals, irrespective of what sort of job they may hold in society, and a willingness to finance that from a tax perspective and implement a fiscal policy that aligns with that cultural view.
When liberal politicians suggest we look for policy-making inspiration from social democracies in Europe, the automatic reaction from some corners of the American political scene is something like, well then, move to Sweden, or love it or leave it. But today, reflecting upon the millions of women, men, and children who participated in the historical march over the weekend, it's pretty clear that advocating for change is part of why we do love it. There's no reason that we can't take lessons from other systems in our collective pursuit of a more perfect union, not to mention a more healthy environment. This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a peek at how the Dutch do things. I speak with two American environmentalists based in the Netherlands to get their perspective on Holland's environmental policies and practices. Michael Payne, a wind energy and bicycle advocate, and Mike Fawcett, the founder of Farm Zero, join me to discuss the cultural, economic, and financial keys to Dutch sustainability. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mike Fawcett and Michael Payne, coming to us live from the Netherlands. Michael and Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, Alex.
We've had you both on the show in the past. You're both sustainability experts, and you're both expats, both Americans living in the Netherlands. First, why don't you give us kind of a little refresher on your backgrounds? So, Michael Payne, why don't you go first? Tell us a little bit about your background in the sustainability field, if you will.
Sure. Thanks, Alex. So I have lived in the Netherlands about 10 years in total now. Most of that time, I've been working in the utility scale wind industry, developing large projects in Europe and in Asia. And in addition to that sort of perspective on how the world's evolving, I've spent the last 3 years running a bicycle advocacy organization in Houston, Texas, and have just moved back to the Netherlands after doing that to try and help Houston move the peanut down the field and gradually become slightly more bicycle friendly, as the Dutch have managed to demonstrate to me and others in the world.
And you are you have a long history of working in the wind power industry as well, right?
Right. So prior to getting involved in urban development and bicycle advocacy, I spent about 15 years working in the wind industry in both the United States and then in Europe and Asia.
And Mike Fawcett, why don't you tell us what Farm Zero is and give us an executive summary of your sustainability background.
Sure, glad to. We started Farm Zero about 4 years ago, the commercial entity. And basically the objectives of the organization are to develop sustainable agriculture projects in parts of the world where it's really difficult or impossible to do agriculture, to do it well, and certainly to do it on a commercial basis. The foundation of the technology that we use uses seawater to cool and to humidify growing environments in the places that are otherwise difficult to do so because it's too hot or too dry or there isn't enough water. So we do that commercially in certain parts of the world. We're also now, having just developed a nonprofit foundation in December, doing nonprofit projects primarily at this point in the Horn of Africa, where using similar technologies we are trying to do projects that can help to feed parts of the world that otherwise couldn't feed themselves, and to change the paradigm of how food aid gets to that part of the world. Rather than dropping a bag of rice on a community that can't feed itself, it's more a shift to helping these communities to develop agricultural projects that allow them to feed themselves and to do it over the long term.
So I wanted to have fun with this, but I think it could be educational. The basic thesis of today's show is, let's pretend that the Dutch Empire from the 17th century is back. The Dutch rule the world. Now, they're doing things a lot different, but they're doing things the way they do them today. There's no evil Dutch slavery colonization. They're the benign Netherlands that we know and love of today. So since both of you are not only in the sustainability space, but are keenly aware of the differences between how the U.S. goes about using its energy, how it designs its transportation, how it recycles, and how it's done in the Netherlands, we wanted to hypothesize on what if the Dutch ruled the world today? What would a walk down Central Park look like? Or what would my commute from my section of San Francisco down to the Embarcadero look like? How would our sustainability approach differ if the Dutch were the lone superpower in the world today?
I think it's a fascinating question, Alex, and it's something I've been discussing with my wife over the last sort of 5 years plus, and even going as far as kicking around the idea of what would that look like in terms of a book if we put a book together on that subject. And so you're forcing me to speak more deeply about the issue. From my perspective, I guess I see the Dutch culture as a couple of things. First and foremost, it's a culture that has a history of collaboration and cooperation within the society. And that goes as far as even referring to it as the polder model. And the polder, of course, is the land which has been recaptured from the sea. A large percentage of the Netherlands country used to be underwater due to population density and demand for more arable land. They built dikes. They designed and developed wind mills with an Archimedes screw technology, which would allow them to pump the water back over the dike into the ocean, draining what was then a lake, and then they would begin to farm the land. That doesn't happen when one person wants to do that by themselves. That happens when a community gets together and agrees that it's better for the common good to work together and achieve those results. And that concept is one which sort of pervades their way of decision making, their way of urban planning, their way of allocating resources. And you see that in the country when you visit, and you see that in the quality of the infrastructure, combined with a nice high marginal tax rate of 52%, starting at 65,000 euros a year. That generates revenue, which they are then investing in a lot of different things, ranging from education to infrastructure to renewable energy to all sorts of support mechanisms to achieve the goals they seek to achieve. So I think that collaborative mindset is the starting point. And, and just to sort of contrast that with sort of the opposite extreme of a culture, which you may see in a place like Texas, where the motto is more trust your neighbors, but brand your cattle. And, the lack of population density, it's the opposite extreme. People can do whatever they want to on their land. And, if it's you own it, then you it's your kingdom. And that's a very different perspective than what exists here. And maybe I'll just open with that first point and say, I think that concept is fundamental to addressing larger, more society-wide problems that exist both in the United States as well as around the world.
So Michael, just following up on the polder model for a moment, that sounds like socialism, but the Dutch were some of the most successful capitalists in world history. How would you rectify those two seemingly discordant systems?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how they divided up the arable land in the olden days when they built the dikes and pumped the water back over the fence. But, there's no doubt that the Dutch are very commercially oriented people. They're one of the largest foreign, investors in other countries in the United States, in the UK and elsewhere. I mean, they've amassed tremendous resources, which they're investing globally to support a high quality of life in what is a relatively small country. So I don't think you're accepting a socialist government controls the income of the people approach in doing that, but there's no doubt that it forces a greater respect for income distribution, and there's no question about that.
So, Mike Fawcett, let's think a little more anecdotally and less from a macro standpoint. What were some of the starkest contrasts for you from a sustainability perspective when you moved from the U.S. to the Netherlands?
Well, certainly one of the first things that you're going to encounter is that there are bikes everywhere, that everyone in this country, if they can, bikes everywhere they can. And you will see children piled onto the front and back of bikes of their moms and their dads on the way to school when they're very young, or they will be biking themselves long distances to go to school or to work, because that's the way that folks here deal with that specific issue. They don't take cars if they don't have to. Public transport is generally the best option. If you're heading from one city to another and the public transportation works so extremely well that you could set your clock by it, I think the level and the extent to which people are doing the recycling of a variety of different of recyclable materials is happening to an extraordinary extent, at least in the region in which we're living. This has been privatized. It's not being done directly by the government. So the efficiencies of the private sector come into play. We've had two or three different private organizations that are running the recycling in the region that I'm living in. And each time they have improved the way in which they're doing things, and they've become quite profitable just by collecting the waste from the various households in the area in which we're living. And this moves all the way from everything that you would throw out ordinarily to the green composting type stuff that you'd get just from doing your yard work. And that all goes into a single facility that deals with that at the at a pretty fundamental level. And it's the same for things like batteries and toxics that you'd otherwise face and find in landfills all across the states that now, at least here, are not being put into the landfills. So, you know, the toxicity issues are very low. Things like agriculture and farming, we're not dealing with a whole lot of GMOs because the EU doesn't allow them, but the extent to which GMOs generally crank up the levels of pesticides mean that the pesticide levels, at least here in the Netherlands and throughout much of Europe generally, are far lower than you would see in the US, which means effluent going into our waterways are lower, the toxicity of the waters are quite low, so that the water quality generally is quite high. It's very drinkable and very tasty. Those are a wide range of things that you, on a daily basis, I think would see and say, well, this is pretty great. It's kind of extraordinary.
Said I'd lead you the lowlands, where the sad-eyed prophet say that no man comes. Now should I leave them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm having a group discussion with Michael Payne, a wind energy expert, and Mike Fawcett, the founder of Farm Zero. Michael Payne, maybe you can speak to the behind-the-scenes energy production side of things since you've worked in that area for several decades.
Yeah, I'm happy to try to. In terms of renewable energy, obviously, as Mike Fawcett mentioned, that the Netherlands is at high risk to changes in sea level. And so very early on, they signed on with the European Union to work towards a goal of achieving 20% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020. They've been building onshore wind farms, they've been building solar installations, they're building offshore wind projects as well, which of course is a step change in terms of the complexity and the cost. And you know, they're just, you know, effectively getting on with it in a way that we haven't been able to do on a federal level in the United States. Well, you know, whereas some of the states have passed legislation, have made progress on a national level, we have not been able to achieve consensus on the right way to approach that. So, you know, they're absolutely serious about it. In terms of, you know, the other issue is just energy prices and energy taxes. So when we first, you know, came to the Netherlands, and, you know, over the earlier years, say 10 years ago, 5 years ago, the price of a gallon of gasoline then with the current exchange rate was over $10 a gallon. That in itself, you know, which is largely taxes, is a signal which incents the consumer to change their behavior. Now, the exchange rate has dropped dramatically since then, is almost a 1-to-1 euro to the dollar exchange rate, but it's still, you're talking $6.50 or so a gallon of gasoline, which you pay every time you fill up your car. And then in addition to that, you know, for the privilege of owning and driving a car, you pay road use taxes, which are based on the amount of grams of CO2 per kilometer that your car generates. So we're not really at the level of understanding and knowledge, you know, to be even talking about how many grams of CO2 per mile or per kilometer our cars generate. But you need to, because you can't manage things that you can't measure. And if we're not talking about that, if we're not talking about our individual carbon footprints in the United States, then we're going to have a hard time, you know, making adjustments or managing them. So, you know, they're taking real steps to quantify and manage the issues that are associated with our children's future and our children's children's future.
The Dutch railway industry now has also mentioned that within the next couple of years, it will be run solely on renewable energy.
They have passed legislation in the House now in the Netherlands prohibiting the sale of gasoline-fueled or diesel-fueled automobiles after 2025. So, you know, you're talking about a country which is committed to making the transition to electric mobility, and they've already put the legislation in place to make that happen. If you want to operate a taxi at the largest airport in the country, Schiphol, one of the most important airports in Europe, you have to have an electric vehicle in order to do that. So you come out of Schiphol, you're going to be getting in an electric taxi, but that's the only way you can operate a taxi there. So this commitment to electrification is major. They're actually, you know, one of the first countries, and first Amsterdam has recently announced they're shutting off natural gas service to like 5,000 residences as the first step in a transition to shut off all the natural gas in individual homes as an effort to reduce carbon emissions and be more efficient through the supply of heat and energy for cooking through electricity rather than natural gas. So, you know, these are major steps. And this is a natural gas producing country. Keep in mind, they have major natural gas supplies in the country themselves, which they'll use to generate electricity, but, you know, they don't feel it's most efficient to pipe it into people's houses. Even when the infrastructure has already been paid for, they're going to, you know, just write that off.
We haven't really branched out into our imaginary world where the Dutch control many other countries. So many people would say, well, this is all fine and dandy. The Netherlands can do this because they don't have gross inequality. They don't have severe poverty. They're a small country physically. Everyone can bike everywhere. What if we had this same kind of government without the climate deniers here in the United States, for example? What would be some of the first steps that a Netherlands-backed government could realistically implement to improve the way we approach sustainability here in the U.S.?
Well, I think, Alex, the first thing you'd have to assume is that they would not implement the Polder model. They would just, as a dictator, apply their own decision-making process to the United States rather than ask people in the various states what they would like to see happen. Because, you know, let's just take the issue of urban planning. And, you know, when you come into the large airport on the outskirts of your city, whichever city you may be talking about, you land and you get in your dirtbag taxi and start heading down the highway, which is, you know, lined by small strip malls and strip joints. You know, they don't allow that here. So from an urban planning perspective, land use is heavily regulated. And so what you could say, and you would get the cry from the real estate owners, you're depressing the value of my land by forcing me to keep all of this land along the side of the highway agricultural. Their argument would be, well, that will be more beautiful for everyone. We'll keep the people in the cities. The higher urban densities will be more efficient to supply in terms of transportation infrastructure, as well as energy infrastructure and everything else that goes along with it. That will be more cost effective and it'll be more beautiful for us. So, you know, get used to that change. And I think you'll like it as you do get used to it.
So a longer term view.
Correct.
That landowner who owns the strip mall property that didn't get to turned into a strip mall in this example would actually benefit in the long term, because that property would be at a premium if it's a more livable place. Is that
well?
Kind
it may
of the
never
idea?
Be zoned. It may never be zoned residential or commercial. I mean, you know, I think, you know, what you see in the Netherlands as you drive between cities is, even though it's the most densely populated country in Europe, you don't feel that here. You drive through green spaces. It's aesthetically very pleasing. And the reality is that they're just not planning on developing that land anytime in the near future. So, you know, if you want to, you know, build something new, then you need to, you know, you need to go to an area that's been zoned appropriately and it's going to be closer to the population centers.
In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who sings of the dreams that he brings from the wide open sea. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who sleeps while the riverbank weeps to the old willow tree. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who dies, full of beer, full of cries, in a drunken town fight. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to both Michael Payne and Mike Fawcett from the Netherlands. Maybe Mike Fawcett, you can speak to how the political process works there. If there was a creeping right wing similar to what we have in the U.S., which is now dominating the political process, would it be able to inject itself into the public debate? It seems like there's such uniformity in terms of rational policy making.
Yeah, it's a great question, and the reality is it would have a difficult time injecting itself into the debate in the same way that it does in the U.S. We have our own homegrown Donald Trump here in the Netherlands. He's actually been doing the Trump thing for a lot longer than Trump has. His name is Geert Wilders, and he's a guy who has been around for a very long time, talking a lot about Islamization of Europe and about the challenges that Islam presents to communities in Western Europe. And so there is an awful lot of that going on. The challenge for a party like his, which at the moment, if we were to have a vote in the Netherlands, which is coming up soon, the challenge for his party is that he has to get enough of the other parties in the Netherlands to work with him. He can't by himself have a controlling interest, as it were, in the policy of the country based solely on the fact that his party is the largest. He has to have a coalition government work together with him in order to be able to implement the policies and his objectives. The problem is that he has to have enough seats in the parliament in order to be able to do this. And the other challenge is that none of the other parties want to work with him. So the ability for his right-wing organization to really get the bully pulpit and do the things that it wants to do without the assistance of the other parties is virtually impossible. So even though the largest party in the Netherlands would essentially win the next election, they won't be part of the ruling government because no one's willing to work with them. So if you're too far in one direction or too far in another direction, your ability to essentially manage the government in the way that would be possible in the U.S. disappears.
And as we see, if you're moderate there, you're completely way out on the left wing in the U.S., the equivalent of what you're talking about as a moderate Dutch politician. What would you attribute that to, Michael Payne?
My answer is that this is a deeply rooted cultural issue that goes back to a view around how people are treated. I would go as far as it ties back into the religious history of the country and almost into sort of the Protestant perspective, where having a lot of wealth is not something that's flaunted or encouraged, it's discouraged, where people are treated as equals irrespective of what sort of job they may hold in society, and a willingness to finance that from a tax perspective and implement a fiscal policy that aligns with that cultural view. I don't know how others would answer it, but that would be my perspective on it, that it's deeply rooted.
So Michael Payne, you worked in bicycle advocacy in Houston, and Mike Fawcett, you had mentioned how you'll see bikes loaded up with families riding around. That doesn't sound very safe, but I've biked in the Netherlands. It's an incredibly easy place to bicycle. This is not something that just happened, though. There was incredible forethought into the planning of this. Why don't you speak to that, Michael Payne?
Fundamentally, the culture has embraced safe cycling, you know, from top to bottom, you know, beginning with the education of children in schools about how to ride safely. So, you know, in addition to getting it from your parents, you're learning safe cycling at school. And, you know, they take safety seriously. They teach kids how to swim here. Everyone's required to learn how to swim as well because of the canals that are so pervasive, and because the dams, you know, and being living below sea level, you know, in the 50s, the dikes failed and 2,000 people drowned, you know, at a point as well. So, that, you know, safety is paramount in terms of education, in terms of the infrastructure they're developing. They're building separated bikeways where the cyclist has their own space to ride. It's designed carefully. Cyclists have right-of-ways at roundabouts. You know, lots of great examples of well-thought-out infrastructure. When there are fatalities, they don't just take the body and throw it in the van and drive off like they do in the United States and keep going. And, you know, that information never gets through to the planning department or to the public works department in the public cities and the city governments in the United States. Here, they spend a lot of time and energy understanding what went wrong at that particular intersection and determining whether or not improvements could be made to avoid fatalities in the future. And then they make the changes. So, you know, I think it's a comprehensive approach which covers education, infrastructure, laws, and the enforcement of the laws that make it safe and make it a really enjoyable place for people to get out and use their bikes year-round. I mean, it's great to see.
Michael Payne, Mike Fawcett, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Lee Morgan, Bob Dylan, and David Bowie. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.